right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And really looking forward to today's show. We're going to spend the first half hour talking with Ted Rall. Ted Rall is a cartoonist, author, political commentator. He's written a number of books. He's written about 16 books, I think, and he's the winner of numerous awards and honors, including the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award for Outstanding Coverage of the Problems of the Disadvantaged, twice, and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His books include The Generation X Polemic, Revenge of the Latchkey Kids, The Anti-American Manifesto, and To Afghanistan and Back, the first book about the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. But today, we're going to be talking about his latest work, The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. Now, this book, it's a fascinating book, and it's really one that makes you think, okay? And right after our conversation with Ted Rall, we'll be joining Larry Everest, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're going to be talking about the latest threats from Israel concerning an upcoming attack on Iran. And, you know, what it says about the relationship between the U.S. and Israel and the situation in the Middle East overall. And like I said, it'll be coming up at the end of the show, so stay tuned for that. But now I'm really happy to welcome to the show Ted Rall. Ted, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And let me tell you, as you heard, really impressed with the book, man. Really impressed. I thought,
Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
And I think it's really something that gives makes people think. You know, it really makes people think, and I think that's something that we need. And I'll start off with asking you a question about this. In the beginning of the book, you talk about how Obama unwittingly set the stage for the greatest surge of political consciousness in our lifetime. What are you talking about there?
Well, I'm talking about the difference between personality politics and policy politics. If you look at the United States under George W. Bush, it was possible for many people, including those of us on the left, to think, well, you know, if we just had a better president, if we just had a better administration, we'd be in better shape. And a lot of people felt that way. And, you know, certainly when he was elected, most people thought that Obama would be better than Bush. Of course, that turned out not to be true in many respects. In some ways, he's worse. But at the time, there was that optimism among particularly liberals and many progressives. And I think what happened with Obama is he unwittingly did what Eric Alterman, the liberal writer, said. You know, Eric Alterman said, you know, I don't know why people are complaining. He is absolutely the best president that this system is capable of allowing to come to power. And I replied, yes, that's exactly right, and that's the problem. So he is absolutely the best, most liberal, most progressive, nicest, kindest, most presentable president that we are going to have under this system of the two-part, the duopoly under this system version of free market capitalism. And that's precisely it exposes the nature of the system as being the problem, not the personality. I mean, if you look at the late period Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev kind of served the same purpose because the system wasn't working for people. And so when he came in and was doing pretty much as good a job as the guy in his position could do, but the system still wasn't delivering, it exposed the system as the problem, not the personality. Well, here you have, under Obama, for the last 4 years, you've had the biggest problems faced by the country, namely the environment and, of course, the economy. And they've gone not only unaddressed intelligently, they've just gone unaddressed. So you don't even have a system that's coughing up stupid or ineffectual solutions. You have a system that's not even discussing solutions. So it's really kind of insane. The economy's in worse shape than it was in the Great Depression. You have the same unemployment rate, 23% in real terms, if the rate were calculated the way it was at the time, but coupled with high inflation, which was not a problem that working people had to deal with in the 30s. So it's worse. And yet, everyone is, you know, the media and the government are talking as if everything were normal. This was a cyclical downturn. Everything is going to come back. Well, it's not, and certainly not going to, because there's complete inaction on the part of the political class. The thing is that doing something about the economy would require redistributing wealth, which goes completely contrary to their entire raison d'etre and their main method of operating, which is to extract wealth from the poor and middle classes and bring it up into the hands of a shrinking elite. So the system has now been exposed. And for people on the right who belong to the Tea Party, who joined the Tea Party, and people on the left who joined Occupy Wall Street, and other people who've been radicalized by the current situation, they have seen that the problem is not Barack Obama, or, and in fact, the problem was not George W. Bush. The problem was the American system of government, which does not work to serve their needs.
And we're talking with cartoonist and author Ted Rall about his latest book, The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. You know, one of the things I was thinking about as I was reading the book and as you're talking now is that there really was an element of Obama being a trump card that this system played. And they may be thinking they might have played it a little too soon, but they really did play this card that we could kind of, like, you say it yourself. You know, what is the best thing that he's doing for this system? Well, basically, he's the first black president. He can get away with a whole lot of stuff because he can speak nicely to people. He can act friendly. He can do all this other stuff. Meanwhile, his jaws are dripping with blood. And you make a point that Obama really didn't fool the people, because a lot of people came out to vote for him and were really, I mean, look, if you stood up against Obama in those days, during the 2008 election, if you stood up against Obama and talked about what is going on here, you were in a pretty lonely room. But you make a point that Obama didn't fool us. We fooled ourselves, because everybody keeps saying this thing about, well, we were fooled, or we thought he was going to do this, we thought he was going to do this. But you make the point that we actually fooled ourselves. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, well, you know, the president is a lying sack. He wouldn't be if he wasn't a politician. But you know, he's not as much of a lying sack, you know, as most of these guys. I mean, on so many issues, he made very clear where he stood early on. I mean, this was a guy who was affiliated with the Democratic Leadership Council, which was the Clinton era organization dedicated to moving the Democratic Party to the right. He was a Clinton Democrat from very early on. When he first emerged as a possible frontrunner for the Democratic nomination in late 2007, I went back to look at his votes on the Iraq War, because after all, he became prominent by giving a speech that opposed the war. And while he was giving those speeches opposing the war, he voted 6 times in favor of funding the war, 0 times against it. So it was very clear from his votes that we were talking about a warmonger, a militarist, someone who was saying one thing and doing another. But the votes don't lie, and the votes were there for anybody who cared to read the newspaper. So it was just a matter of finding and looking them up. And it was like this all across the board. He said that he was going to double down in Afghanistan, but liberals chose to pretend like that didn't happen. I mean, you know, the Obama denialism continues apace. It might right now, my old friend, the author Dave Eggers, has a website up called 90 Reasons in 90 Days, where Obama apologists are encouraged to post one reason per day for why you should bunch and vote for Obama. And I really seriously encourage anyone who's a student of illogic to check it out, because it is hilarious. The irrational thinking at work includes reasons like, you know, I am currently traveling overseas and learning a lot from meeting people of different cultures. And I like the fact that Obama visited many countries too. And so obviously he must have gotten tons of insight as well. It's literally things like that. And the thing is that the many liberals, and I don't include myself in among them because I wrote extensively at the time that he was not a leftist, that he was not a liberal. I mean, you know, by the standards of 1960, Obama would be far too far to the right to run as a Republican. He would be considered too crazy to the right of a Barry Goldwater. But he did fool many people who, I think, looked at the Hope and Change posters and looked at the tone of this man. And I think the coding, you know, of the fact that he was an African-American president, for many people, they're accustomed to African-American political figures being to the left, people like Al Sharpton before he went on MSNBC and became a Democrat apologist, and Jesse Jackson, who were without a doubt progressive Democrats, and were sort of used to African Americans meaning progressive Democrats. And that just isn't the case with Barack Obama. By the standards of the system itself, he is a conservative.
We're talking with Ted Rall, author and cartoonist, and he's the author of The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. Now, Ted, one of the things that, and I, you know, what you were just saying really, I think it really gets to this point as well. And when you're talking about all this in terms of how people do this, you know, even the Dave Eggers, you know, website, which it's amazing because this is not going to, he's not going to be alone in all this by any means. You know, it's funny. It's not actually funny. It's sick. When Obama gave his speech announcing how he was going to ratchet up all the troops in Afghanistan, he was going to send tens of thousands more troops to Afghanistan. The very next day, a whole army of apologists arrived on the scene, and they had been there, but they hadn't been speaking out. Now, this is the very next day. They're already getting into the coming election and how this just shows that we really have to have, you know, we have to have Obama in there because The other guys would be worse, and because we'll be able to hold his feet to the fire. And this is something that keeps going on and on and on. And now they're coming up with this thing of, well, at least he's not as bad as the bad guys. And if we don't vote for him, the bad guys will win. And here's a cat who has done, as you said, more than Bush was able to do in implementing the Bush program.
Yeah, well, he's definitely far to the right of George W. Bush on issues like torture and assassinations. And, you know, there would have been, ironically, more pressure. I mean, George W. Bush did more about, for instance, renewing unemployment benefits than Obama has done. You know, there's more pressure on Republicans to not act as total right-wing pigs than there is on Democrats. I mean, look, it's a two-party trap. It's been pointed out before. You know, it's kind of like you're at a restaurant and the choices are, which would you rather eat, pee or poo? And I would just rather eat somewhere else. So that's
okay. Okay, I won't be going out to lunch today. Yeah. Well, and that's important. But again, this is the thing that I think we really have to deal with. And I think it plays into the thing, too, of both the Trump card situation with Obama, as well as, you know, you make a point that one of the things we have to deal with in this country in particular is Americans in politics, that people don't merely hate politics, but they pretend that they don't exist, which I think is really very much related to the whole idea that everything is decided in and the way to change is, you know, cemented in what you do inside that voting booth all by yourself with the curtain wrapped around you and pushing things or marking things or whatever. You know, that's the role you have in changing the world, as opposed to actually being out in the streets, being part of a revolutionary movement. Instead, your job is to go in every 4 years by yourself and mark which one of these pigs is going to rule you. You know, and to me, I think exactly what you're saying is part and parcel of that whole setup.
As I wrote in the book, we have a political system that's devoid of politics. I mean, it's a horse race. It's, you know, it's of interest in the same way that the World Series is of interest. You're not directly vested. Those people are not there for you. Certainly money is involved in this election. It's a clash between older money. The big banks are supporting Obama, and the new hedge funds are supporting Romney. But neither party has our interests at stake. It's a clash of Godzilla versus Megaton. And, you know, they're both monsters, and they're both going to break a lot of things as they fight it out. But it's not something that stands to benefit you. And, you know, we need a political system that is for everybody. And that, I mean, we need a society that allows the best and brightest people to come to the fore and step forward and make their contributions to giving us good ideas that we can debate and discuss. And as a people, we need to get together and hash out what are the best ways we can move forward to make the world and to make our country a better place. But we don't have that system. So people say, well, what should I do this fall? I say, I don't care what you do this fall. Vote, don't vote. Just don't think that it matters. It's like recycling. You know, recycling is lifestyle activism. You know, it's polite. I do it. I don't think I'm going to save the world because I do it. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it, and I certainly don't think it's going to save the world. Well, you know, voting is lifestyle politics. You're making a symbolic gesture, and it's fun to meet the old ladies down at the precinct, and you know, it's charming and all that. But don't think that it makes any difference. That's not politics. Politics is out in the streets. It always has been. It always will be. And in the end, politics will require a little more oomph than holding up a sign. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's really the takeaway here. So, you know, if people are too cheap to buy the book or to lean on their library to order a copy, there it is. I've just given it to you. Stop thinking about the election. The election doesn't matter.
All right. Now, that's going to be kind of – actually, you know, I wish that would provoke a whole board of phone calls right now, because it's really that – that's one of the pins that you stick in people's heads that I think is actually extremely important for people to be debating out and to doing something about. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Ted Rall, cartoonist and author, about his latest book, The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. Now, one of the things in terms of this, you have a whole – the whole first chapter or whatever is – about the swindle, and the swindle begins. But then you dedicate a huge section of the book to what Obama has done. Let's talk about that so people are clear. We're not just like, you know, sort of like, it's the typical, they're just finding anything this guy does they wouldn't agree with. Well, you actually document a whole slew of things that actually put meat on the idea that he is worse than Bush, that he is the bad guy in the elections.
Well, he's certainly a bad guy. I mean, I'm not going to argue that Mitt Romney isn't a
right,
pig.
Right, yeah, exactly.
but Obama's a pig, too. And, you know, I mean, really, once you start getting into, like, well, this pig is worse than that pig, why are you arguing about it? And why are you voting? Why are you supporting a system that will inevitably result in some pig getting elected and running your life? So, you know, Matt Bores, my cartoonist who I'm friends with, you know, said that this book is really like a legal case where, you know, it's airtight. You read through it and you remember everything that he was about from the beginning all the way through the present. I mean, there's just a few highlights that people have chosen to forget are, for example, there's not one liberal in Obama's administration. None. I mean, I'm not talking about socialists or communists, which there ought to be, but there aren't. But there's no liberals. There's no one from the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. You know, there's no Paul Krugman. There's no Dennis Kucinich. Who these people are not nearly as far to the left as I would like. You know, you used to see, like, Clinton had Robert Reich in his first administration as Labor Secretary. You don't get those kind of even symbolic token gestures under Obama, and that means he's not even hearing the liberal ideas, much less leftist ones. He has completely escalated the war in Afghanistan and managed, by the way, to convince a lot of people who are going to vote for him that the war in Iraq is coming to an end when nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, the war in Iraq is going to continue with U.S. troops well into the next decade. The U.S. has committed tens of thousands of U.S. mercenaries and quote-unquote training soldiers. You know, back in the early days of Vietnam, you know, a training mission was considered 50 to 100 guys. Now it's 40,000 guys. So they're not trainers. These are combat troops. And we have all those guys from the company that used to be called Blackwater who are there working for us. You know, we have an extensive infrastructure in Iraq. And in Afghanistan, we just signed an agreement with the Karzai puppet regime to maintain troops until 2024 at least. So this is, you know, the war is ongoing. Even George W. Bush never asserted the right to individually assassinate a U.S. citizen on American soil simply with the stroke of a presidential pen. But Barack Obama does assert that right and has exercised it on at least one occasion, not on U.S. soil, but he has killed a U.S. citizen using a drone strike. You know, I mean, he invites Nancy Pelosi over to watch snuff videos. It was reported in the New York Times. She comes over and they watch people's head blow up on high-res colored screens. I mean, these are sick, depraved people. Barack Obama is a monster. He might be a cute one, but he's a monster. And people need to focus on that.
Well, just along those lines, I think one thing that people keep constantly forgetting that when he came into office, he kept saying this thing about, I'm going to close down Guantanamo. Then you look at what you reveal about torture in general around this. And there's two things I wanted to touch on here. Torture is one of them. And then I'd also like to talk about something that I thought was very, very heavy because people just don't follow this enough, the Patriot Act and the renewal of the Patriot Act and some of the things that you brought out there. But let's talk about torture first.
Okay. In terms of torture, one of the weaselly things that Obama did was to sign an executive order banning torture by military personnel. However, you know, George W. Bush never allowed torture by military personnel either. He said that it was okay for the CIA and NSA and other national security agencies to carry out torture. Well, Barack Obama never repealed those rights at all. And don't forget, to all of George W. Bush's torturers and the people who enabled them, like Alberto Gonzalez, were given a free pass when Obama came in. He said, you know, people want to move on. Well, that's not what he promised. He promised that we would, at bare minimum, have sort of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission kind of thing where we'd get to find out exactly what happened and maybe a full-fledged investigation. But he reneged on that when he took over. And, you know, there was just a flurry of really sad moves to the right after Obama came in. And now it's we've forgotten that. It's really indistinguishable from when a Republican president comes in because they make a bunch of sad moves to the right, too. Both parties are just constantly moving the needle over to the right. And for older listeners, all they have to do is think back about the older races between people like Kennedy and Nixon and Goldwater and Johnson, and think about where those people would fall today on the political spectrum. Even Richard Nixon, who, you know, was a right-wing pig and a warmonger and conducted a secret war in Cambodia and Laos, even Richard Nixon enforced wage and price controls that really infuriated corporations and would never be tolerated today. He would be considered a socialist today, for sure. You know, so that's how far the needle has moved under the system. I mean, people who say, well, you got to vote Democratic to keep the Republican out. You know, I've been voting Democratic for years, and you know what? The country keeps moving to the right. So it's not really working out too well.
And we're talking with cartoonist and author Ted Rall about his latest book, The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. Actually, one of the things that you talked about that, again, I don't, you know, it's sort of one of these things that happens. People go, oh, what? And then they move on. The Patriot Act renewal. And you bring out something about that apparently Obama, according to Senator Ron Wyden, did something where he added to the reactionary essence of the Patriot Act in terms of its interpretation of something. This man is pushing ahead with one of the most reactionary programs, all these fascistic things that were sort of coming in the wake of the Patriot Act, and he turns around and immediately renews it and adds to it.
Yeah, no, I mean, the thing is, it's like if you read through the book of Obama, you're just going to see one thing after another that's going to hopefully trigger your memory and remind you, like, this is what's going on. This is what happened. There's no denying it. I mean, you know, you could sit there and point to the, you know, the occasional woman judge that Obama has passed. But, you know, really, truly, like, for instance, if you really scratch the surface of these gestures that are laudable, supposedly, you're not going to find a lot of substance there. You know, for example, one of the Dave Eggers website entries talks about how he improved fuel efficiency standards. But the truth is, those fuel efficiency standards that Obama signed into law are the same exact fuel efficiency standards that Detroit had previously announced that they were going to enact anyway, because that's what the market now calls for. With sky-high gas prices, people just want more fuel-efficient cars. So he literally had no effect whatsoever. And you don't have to believe a word that I'm saying. You can look it all up, and you know, in the book, everything's footnoted anyway.
Now, Ted, we have probably time for two more questions. We have about 5 minutes, but I wanted to ask you one really quick. In the face of all this, a lot of people are still going to come at you with this argument that, well, what do you want? Obama's hands are tied by the strength of the opposition, in Congress in particular. What do you say to that?
Well, I think his hands were certainly not tied the first year and a half that he was in office. I mean, you know, if people forget that when Obama came in, he had an extraordinary amount of political goodwill. He came into a country that was shedding 600,000 jobs a month. People were scared to death, and they would have done pretty much anything that he wanted. The media honeymoon was extraordinary. He enjoyed more power with Congress in terms of having Democratic control of both the House and the Senate than any president since FDR, and by some standards, more. He had a filibuster-proof majority in the U.S. Senate. He had control of many state houses as well. The Democrats had taken over in the 2008 sweep. You know, in short, if he'd come in and said, I want to directly employ 20 million Americans under a new WPA and start building stuff again and extend unemployment benefits indefinitely and create socialized health care and a whole slew of other left-wing agenda items, he would have gotten them through, no problem. The thing is, he chose not to do those things. No Republicans were tying his hands until after the 2010 midterm elections. And the only reason that all those Republicans came in was because liberal enthusiasm was had collapsed because he hadn't done anything for 2 years. The only major accomplishment that Obama has is the Health Care Act. And that, too, was a betrayal because he never pushed for the public option.
We're talking with cartoonist author Ted Rall about his latest book, The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. All right, we'll move into this last question, and we're really going to have to run through this in about 3 minutes, but it's one of the very most important questions, I think, that's out there right now, which is, you believe that the system is unreformable, irredeemable, and only revolution will open the door to resolving all the ills of the society, and I'd add here and around the world. But you raise a question in the book, and I think it's an important question, and I really appreciated the way you answered this. Why you, as a middle-aged, middle-class, relatively comfortable artist and author, support a revolution and a complete restructuring of the society?
Well, because there's just simply no other, there's no other solution. You know, the system is but was irredeemable to begin with, because it was based on the idea that we're not all created equal, that some people deserve to be born rich and other people deserve to be born poor. So it was always irredeemable. Now I think that there's a revolutionary opportunity because it's also unreformable. You know, you can just, there's a new book that came out fairly recently called You Can't Be President. And it explains basically why, you know, the best and the brightest can't become president. Well, you know, any system where the best and the brightest can't lead is probably not a good system. It's ossified. You know, I mean, there's the classic Marxist division between the ruling classes in play right now, where we see certain elites like Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank, and Warren Buffett, who know that we're headed toward the path of collapse and or revolution unless they do something to reduce inequality of wealth and income. But they're in the minority. They've lost the internal struggle between the ruling classes to those who are just trying to loop the system as fast as they can. And that tells you that we are on the path toward either collapse or revolution. Now, I think collapse is more likely. We don't have a revolutionary organization that is poised in a position to take over the country yet. But if the choice is between revolution and reform, revolution and collapse, I would rather have revolution with all the risks that entails, because post-Soviet-style collapse would be disastrous.
All right, Ted, on that note, we're going to have to move on. But I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care now. Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we have been talking with political cartoonist and author Ted Raw about his new book, The Book of Obama, From Hope and Change to the Age of Revolt. This is really a worthwhile read, especially these days as they are once again pulling on us to drop everything, drop all of our hopes of change, and push ourselves back into that voting booth and once again pull a lever and do nothing. And meanwhile, the system continues to grind on all over the world, grinding up countless numbers of human beings. So hopefully our discussion with Ted Raw has stuck a few pins in your brain and made you think about the big things that are up for grabs right now. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Larry Everest, journalist and author, about the new situation in the Middle East, and especially the threat of a new war, this time against Iran. So stay tuned.
Political rhetoric, I know it is all lies. Doublespeak, duplicity, you can just read it in the eyes. See the silver-plated squirming of the tongue. Some sycophant, a corporate slave, announces we will bomb. You fill the world with little wars by feeding tyrants arms. As long as they are subservient, how could there be qualms? Customers must not fight back what happens when they do, to spin a tale of right and wrong and gloss over the truth. Visions and voices all make a better world. War no more. Voices of the future speak. Voices of the future speak.
All right, welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was Voices of a Future from Pac and the Space Goats. And that was on Peace Not War, a disc put out a couple of years ago to speak out against war, and has all kinds of artists speaking out against war. And as we approach this situation today, we all better be thinking about just that kind of stuff, speaking out against war. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest, Larry Everest. Larry's a journalist with Revolution Newspaper. He's a frequent guest on this show. He's the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're here to talk about some recent disturbing, very disturbing developments in the Middle East concerning Israel, Iran, and the U.S. Just recently, Benjamin Netanyahu has been, there's been all kinds of talk about how Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, is out there calling for an Israeli strike against Iran and its nuclear capacity, its supposed nuclear capacity. And it's been taking all kinds of different forms, including most recently, where earlier this month, the deputy foreign minister called for an international declaration that the diplomatic effort to halt Tehran's enrichment of uranium is dead. This same minister said that the UN Security Council plus Germany should declare that the talks have failed. And after such a declaration, if Iran does not halt its nuclear program, it will be clear that all options are on the table, not only for Israel, but also for the United States and NATO. And when he was asked how long the Iranians should be given to cease all nuclear activity, this deputy foreign minister stated that it was weeks and not more than that. Larry, how serious is this threat? How are you looking at it?
Well, I think it's very serious. It was reported on Channel 2 in Israel August 11th and 12th that Netanyahu was either very close to making a decision or had already decided to strike Iran before the November presidential election. And there's a big debate about whether this is going to happen or whether this is just a bluff. I just read a piece by a former national security advisor, Gary Sick, who feels there won't be war. It would be against Israel's interest. Israel could not destroy Iran's nuclear program. It would cause a backlash against Israel. It wouldn't stop the nuclear program, but it could trigger a conflict that would end up undermining Israel and the U.S. and perhaps even create some kind of global economic crisis. So there are a lot of people out there that are really discounting this or feeling that all the talk from Israel, and remember, Michael, this has been building. There have been tensions and conflicts with Iran for over 30 years. They've escalated since September 11th, 2001. And in just the last year, it's gone to a whole other level that this talk of war has been escalating. So there a lot of people are sort of dismissing this as simply an effort to increase the pressure on the United States and the world to focus on Iran and to intensify the sanctions, intensify the covert operations, keep the pressure on. I don't think that's the whole story here, though, because I think what that doesn't get to, and again, I'm not arguing that war is a foregone conclusion, and I'm not arguing that one can take what one reads in the newspapers, Israeli or the U.S. at face value, and that's the only element of the story. But what a lot of these denials, the analysis that a war against Iran to halt its nuclear program could backfire and is very, very risky, those are true points. But what these kind of analyses aren't seeing, and with what I think is more fundamental and why I'm very, very concerned about this, is that it's missing the deeper driving necessities that could cause Israel and or the U.S. to launch an attack on Iran, even knowing it's risky, that they may assess, given these deeper necessities, given the kind of states they are and what their whole power and existence is based on, they may judge that the risks of not acting are greater than the risk of acting.
We're talking with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the latest Israeli threats to open up a war against Iran and its supposed nuclear capacity. Well, let me ask you this, Larry, because that's exactly the place I wanted to go. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, there is a point here where when you think about this, first of all, Netanyahu and the whole move of the Israeli regime to actually put out this thing about declare the talks dead, to float out the idea, the actual, in more concrete terms than ever before, the idea that a military attack against Iran is coming. This whole idea of mobilizing all the various imperial states to get behind them to say that the talks are dead in the water and that Iran should only have a matter of weeks to do something that might be able to forestall such an attack. This is a very, very serious escalation, even in the verbal war that they have going against Iran and that they've had going. I'd like to talk a little bit about the necessities facing both Israel and the U.S., because here's the thing. When you look at the situation in the Middle East, it's far from like just sort of a walk in the park. There is so much upheaval. There's so much at play in the Middle East right now. You have the stuff that happened in the Sinai. You have whatever's going on in Syria and Lebanon. You have all these things that are just roiling and boiling over. And to bring this into the picture would seem to really add an element that, I don't know, man, it's a pretty explosive situation. Why? What's the necessity? What's driving all this?
Well, first of all, one thing to think about is that, and this is a one answer to those who downplay, in my view, and again, it's not that they're not seeing some of the reality, but one thing they're not taking into account is if you look at this overall trajectory, beginning in 1979 with the Iranian Revolution, but particularly after September 11th, 2001, and especially after it was discovered Iran did have a nuclear program in 2002, this trajectory toward confrontation and war, as we analyzed in Revolution Newspaper in 2008, has escalated. It's greatly escalated. Throughout this period, there have been many people saying, oh, we don't need to escalate this. We should make a deal with the Iranians. They're reasonable, so on and so on. Never happened, because the interests of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the interests of the United States imperialists in Israel are in a fundamental conflict, and it's the fundamental conflict is over the fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran is a challenge to unfettered U.S. military and political hegemony in that region. They kind of concentrate that challenge. The nuclear issue is a part of that that makes that challenge to U.S. and Israeli hegemony even greater. Now, Iran isn't the only challenge, as you were pointing out, but that's the underlying driving thing. And the challenge to U.S. hegemony has intensified as the Islamic Republic has remained in power, as the results of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan have ended up strengthening Iran. It's escalated as those wars have actually fueled Islamic fundamentalism across the region, which has both increased Iran's influence in certain ways, but also weakened the U.S. And then, as you were pointing out, we have the whole situation of the upheaval across the Arab world, which doesn't always directly benefit Iran. It isn't Iran's gaining, gaining, gaining. The Islamic Republic, a reactionary theocracy, has all kinds of contradictions internally. It's facing different kinds of contradictions around the world, but it means that the playing field in the whole region is tilting in very, very unpredictable ways, all of which means that the U.S. is more intent and Israel are more intent on taking down this regime than ever before. And that was seen very clearly in the fact of these negotiations, which broke down because the U.S. and the European powers refused various compromise offers from Iran, in which Iran offered to give up their 20% enrichment or to have it more closely supervised or shipped overseas and so on in return for guarantees that they would get it as long as they would be able to still enrich at 3%, which is what you need for a nuclear reactor. But that was rejected. That shows you right there that the point of these negotiations are to weaken and ultimately take down the Islamic Republic. In fact, the Wall Street Journal carried an article recently in which said, look, it's clear the point of sanctions aren't going to change Iranian behavior. What they're there for is to weaken this regime and facilitate regime change.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Larry Everest, the writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the recent statement by Israel that it seems like they think it's time to launch a military attack on Iran. And Larry, one of the things that that's come up in this, and that there's been a lot of sort of speculation about too, is that usually when we have talked about Israel in the past, we've always gotten down to the point that essentially, fundamentally, because of the kind of thing that you're talking about in terms of the necessity that the U.S. and Israel face, and that, and because there's this challenge that's posed to the U.S. and to Israel in terms of their regional hegemony and all that stuff, and the relationship, the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel, there's always been this point about, look, the tail doesn't wag the dog, that the Israelis are not going to do something the U.S. doesn't want to do. But this time, there seems to be a lot more talk about somehow there's a big difference between the U.S. and Israel. What's your take on that?
Well, my sense is that, and again, you know, we don't know all the military and intelligence sharing and political agreements that are being secretly and have been agreed to behind closed doors. We don't know the full story, and I think that's important to remember. But at the same time, it does seem that there is a sharp difference, that there is tension between the U.S. and Israel. Look, the deepest level of this is that U.S. domination is a global imperialist power. Its domination and control of this key region, crossroads of the world, 60% to 80% of the world's energy resources and reserves are in this area. This is a key part of U.S. global hegemony and the functioning of the U.S. empire. So people have to understand it. It isn't just by some whim that the U.S. is involved in every country in the Middle East and has been for 60-plus years, or that they're willing to wage war and kill hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people and wreck the lives of millions, as we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, in order to preserve this. So that people have to get a grip on and understand, and a lot of that's one thing people have to face about the nature of this beast. Israel has been the key gendarme of the United States in the Middle East. It's this key, you know, attack force, unsinkable aircraft carrier, and it's a settler colonial state based on the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. So for the most part, the U.S. and Israel have had this special relationship precisely because the Middle East is such a key region and because Israel has played such an important military and political role for the U.S. in attacking different states or nationalist movements, liberation movements that have challenged U.S. control. But at the same time, Israel has its own particular, the U.S.'s broadest interests are global dominance and dominance of this whole region, which means holding together a whole series of alliances and various kinds of states in the region and maintaining military bases throughout the region, not just Israel. But Israel does have some particular necessities of its own. It's a small state. It is dependent on unchallenged military superiority and having a nuclear monopoly in particular. Look, people will argue, oh, Israel doesn't have to worry about Iran's nuclear program because Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon, which is true. No proof that Iran is even trying to get a nuclear weapon. And so there's no reason for this. There's no reason Israel has to go to war. This thing of existential threat is just a bunch of hype. But then people should listen to what the Israeli leadership are actually saying, because they're being forced due to the severity of this crisis to actually speak some truth here. And what they're arguing is that even an Iran as a breakout state, in other words, that has a nuclear program, that doesn't have a nuclear weapon, but could quickly get one. Even Iran as a breakout state is a threat to us because it changes the military balance of power and inhibits Israel's ability to, say, attack Lebanon whenever they feel like it, or attack different countries, or threaten Iran militarily. It changes the calculation. And just think about what kind of a statement that is about the nature of Israeli and U.S. power rests on violence. And the other element of the necessity is, look, as a settler colonial state, Israel depends on people emigrating there. It depends on immigrants from Europe, from Russia, from around the world, to have a sustainable and growing population. I mean, not that the Israeli population isn't growing on its own as well, but historically it's depended on this. And if the perception came that Israel really couldn't, there wasn't really security in Israel because of these great tensions with Iran or other countries in the region, this could fundamentally shake the nature of the state of Israel, given what it is. And Netanyahu, reportedly, the logic of this is that Israel can't, that they understand that the U.S.'s interests are greater and somewhat different than their own. They argue that if they don't take the, that they can't leave their security in somebody else's hands, and the window during which they can take down Iran's or significantly damage Iran's nuclear program before they're able to bury it so deeply underground Israel can't touch it. That window is closing. Now, look, there is logic there. I mean, is that the only element of the calculation? Probably not. Does that assure that there is necessarily going to be a conflict and there aren't other factors that are playing into this, including whatever understandings they have with the Obama administration? Sure there are. But these necessities, these driving necessities, and these considerations about military hegemony and supremacy, including how other players in the region look at this, these are real things that people have to take seriously. And when you get in this kind of uncharted territory and extreme crisis, a lot of stuff you hadn't seen before, like the potential for sharp differences between the U.S. and Israel, can emerge.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, about the increasing tension in the Middle East, and in particular with Israel's threat to wage war against Iran and its supposed nuclear capacity sometime in the near future.
Well, let me ask you this, Larry, and I think I want to hear a little bit more about these differences, because why is the U.S. not saying, all right, you know, whatever, you got no choice? The U.S. is actually sitting there, and some of their people are saying, give the sanctions, these harshest sanctions ever to be imposed on Iran, give them a chance to work. They're really doing all this. There's all this stuff about, you know, the differences, the idea that somehow Israel coming out and saying that they're going to do this within a matter of, you know, and they are saying, at least that one deputy foreign minister is saying, within a matter of weeks, they would like to, you know, that Iran has weeks to actually close down its entire operations. What are the differences that the U.S., why would the U.S. have differences with that? I mean, in a certain sense, since they both are challenged by Iran, wouldn't the Israelis taking this move actually work to the U.S.'s benefit as well?
Well, that's certainly possible. And look, both the U.S. and Israel, as well as the European powers, are united in attempting to strangle Iran. Right now, Iran's lost about half of its national income in the last 6 months due to these sanctions. They're taking a terrible toll on the 80 million Iranians. These are, you know, weapons of mass destruction being directed at the Iranian people right now. The U.S. hasn't had a big problem with spying on Iran and trying to launch these cyber attacks and all sorts of covert operations. All that's going on. In addition, the United States is building up its military presence and the military strength of its allies in the Gulf in preparation for a possible war. And it was very chilling because Ray McGovern wrote recently, posted an article in which he was, you know, talking to sources with, as he put it, with insight into U.S. military preparations, that there have been U.S. military moves that haven't been announced. And that at this point, U.S. forces were on a hair trigger alert. People can see his article on Counterpunch or Consortium, that U.S. forces are on a hair trigger alert, and it was past the time when it would be even worth trying to prevent an accidental confrontation, and so on and so forth. So this is very real, but it does seem to be the case that there are big differences over the issue of timing, because look, the U.S. and Israel understand that a military attack on Iran is in all likelihood an extremely risky and unpredictable proposition. This isn't like storming into Iraq or Afghanistan or so on. This is a whole a much, much bigger, stronger country with different sorts of capacities, I would imagine. And the outcome of this at a time, as you were saying earlier, when the region's all already in upheaval, is very unpredictable. So my sense of it is that the United States wants to increase the pressure on Iran and hope that perhaps a combination of taking down the Assad regime in Syria, and of course what they're doing in Syria is very much directed against Iran, some combination of taking down the Assad regime, of, you know, going after Hezbollah in Lebanon, doing kind of a full court press against Iran that's short of an overt military confrontation, combined with these sanctions, combined with all these covert operations, could cause internal upheaval or crisis in the regime, and they would get the same result without the risk of war. I mean, this could be some of the differences where Israel is saying, well, look, if we wait as long as you're saying we have to wait, then the decision becomes yours to make, because the military capacity we have will not be effective a year from now or 6 months from now, and so we will be effectively beholden to you, and we don't trust you. I mean, this is what's being reported, some of the argument is, and it's conceivable that there's elements of truth to this.
All right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, and we're talking about Israel's threat of launching a military attack against Iran in the not-so-distant future. Now, Larry, one question, and we have about 5 minutes to get into this, but one question here. You know, there's a whole point that a lot of people, and I think this is both true generally in the society, but also especially among people who are somewhat conscious of imperialism and what it does to people around the world, people who have been active or wanted to see an anti-war movement, to a large extent, even though there are some people who are sounding the alarm, there's still a huge sentiment of, look, we've been down this road before. They've cried wolf a number of times before. It's never really come out. What makes this so different than before? And why is it important that people actually even stand up and say something about this now, as opposed to just dismissing it?
Well, first of all, if there's any chance of a war, people should be mobilizing against it now. I can't say absolutely certainly it's going to happen. But there's certainly, one would have to be deaf, dumb, and blind to say there's absolutely no chance of this because of what I've been talking about. The trajectory has clearly escalated. It is not the same as things were 10 years or 5 years ago or 1 year, number one. Number two, the U.S. and Israel and these other powers are already waging a form of unjust war against Iran, which should be denounced, whatever one thinks of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I certainly do not support it at all. But a war against it would be a great crime by imperialism. And finally, people have to dig in and understand. And, you know, I write about this frequently at Revolution Newspaper, and I encourage people to read our coverage of this. People need to confront the deeper necessities that are driving the extreme violence that the U.S. has either directly brought to bear or Israel's brought to bear or supported, facilitated, and so on throughout the Middle East. And I think people also have to understand that when there's upheaval and rapid change and you know, deep contradictions are churning under the surface of events, big things can happen and life doesn't just go on as normal. So for those reasons, no matter what one's precise estimate of exactly how soon or how likely a war is going to be, even the idea that Israel is threatening war or the U.S. is threatening war should be enough for people to get out and condemn this. And look, let's not forget when the U.S. or Israel says all options are on the table, as Daniel Ellsberg has pointed out, this is threatening to use nuclear weapons. That's what it is, and this is outrageous, and should be opposed.
All right, Larry, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael. Okay. I'm glad we could get into this. We've got to keep on top of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will keep you on the air as this develops. So looking forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay, great.
All right. Thanks a lot, man. All right. We've just been talking with journalist and writer Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper. And he's been talking with us about the danger of an Israeli attack on Iran in the very near future, as well as pointing out that while there may be differences between the U.S. and Israel over the timing of such an attack, there are not differences between them over the need to deal with the Iranian regime at some point in the near future. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. Given this last portion of the show, I wanted to read a couple of short quotes to you from Basics, from Bob Avakian's book Basics, and leave you something to think about over the next week. American lives are not more important than other people's lives. Internationalism, the whole world comes first. These are two pithy comments that I think merit all of our attention in the weeks to come, and especially as these war drums begin to beat louder and louder. So keep them in mind. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my guests for today, political cartoonist and author Ted Raw and Larry Everest, journalist with Revolution Newspaper. And I want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. And all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with what has actually become an old standard in my book, and that is International War Criminal by the Slackers. Check this out.
Crawling on his